This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So good afternoon and welcome to the 5th annual UCSF School of Dentistry Global Oral Health Symposium. My name is Benjamin Chaffee. I am the director of our program in Global Oral Health at the School of Dentistry, and I am delighted to see how many people have come out today to see our lineup and support our program, and I expect we'll see more people filing in as the afternoon moves along. So our program and our event, this is now our 5th year, has truly grown as the years have gone by. Really excited by the support we've seen. I think that speaks to certainly the quality of the lineup. We have some outstanding speakers to present today, and we're very proud to have them with us. I think this reflects a really growing interest in global health as a concept in education, as far as it applies to professional education among dentists. I strongly believe that the ideas of making sustainable impacts, of understanding the social determinants of health, of working in an interdisciplinary nation, in an interdisciplinary way with our colleagues, are all principles that are going to separate our graduates as true professionals as opposed to technicians of the mouth. So our theme today is nutrition, sugar, and oral health worldwide. And it's very tempting to say that this is a timely topic, that it could not be more timely as the effects of sugar and nutrition on our health become so profound. This is our 5th annual symposium, and there would not have even been a first if it wasn't for the leadership of Dr. John Greenspan, our first dean for global oral health here at UCSF. It is his vision and forward thinking that brought us all together and made this program possible. You'll hear me thank him many times, but first a thank you and applause to him. And finally, we couldn't be doing this program if it wasn't for the leadership and support of our dean, Dr. John Featherstone, who's been just tremendously supportive. You'll hear him say that global oral health is part of the mission and the strategic plan for our school. We couldn't be more happy about that. It sets the culture all the way from our leadership to our students and everyone working together. So tremendously thankful for him. And in fact, I'm now going to turn over the microphone to Dean Featherstone for a brief greeting.
Thank you, Ben, and I'd like to welcome you all here, welcome the our internal folks, and I look around, I see quite a few people from other parts of the campus here as well, and I see people from all around the world, so this is wonderful. I'm so thrilled that several of our people on campus involved with global health have also embraced the oral health part of it. So again, welcome. And my pleasure now to introduce my colleague and friend, Haile Dabas. Dr. Haile Dabas, please come forward.
Good afternoon. It is a privilege to be part of this year's Symposium on Global Oral Health. But let me start by congratulating Dr. Chaffee for putting on this wonderful symposium. And Dean Featherstone, although after what he said, I don't know if I should say this, but Dean Featherstone and Dr. John Greenspan for seeing early on the importance of global oral health and ensuring that UCSF would play a leadership role. When 4 years ago, the Young Consortium of Universities for Global Health, CUGH, decided to develop global oral health interest group. It was John Greenspan that took the leadership to organize, with lightning speed, I must say, the Global Oral Health Interest Group of CUGH by bringing together the deans of the major U.S. dental schools. Now CUGH has a membership of 130 universities in the Global Oral Health Interest Group, is the best organized and has some of the best symposia in the CUGH annual meeting, which itself has grown last 2 weeks ago in Boston. It was attended by 1,600 people from 50 countries. So, John, congratulations, and also thank you for putting global oral health in the academic global health agenda so prominently. Thank you. Now, communicable diseases are the leading health problem globally, and death attributed to NCDs increased 46% from 1990 to 2010. The world is facing tremendous challenges posed by the rapidly changing burden of chronic diseases. Global oral health is an important and growing component of NCDs. 50% of the world's population, or 4 billion people, suffer from dental caries and periodontitis. Changing diet with ever-increasing consumption of acidic soft drinks and free sugars is the setting of poor nutrition is one of the main culprits causing an epidemic of dental caries and enamel erosions in developing countries. The good news is that we know how to prevent it. The bad news is that the implementation of sound global oral health policies is met with huge barriers. The surgery volume of the World Bank book, Disease Control Priorities, third edition, which was just launched 3 weeks ago at the annual meeting of CUGH in Boston, advocates a dual approach to prevention, a top-down NCD policy change, and pragmatic bottoms-up innovation approach. The 2015 Tokyo Declaration on Dental Care and Oral Health for Healthy Longevity calls upon health policymakers and professionals to significantly reduce the global disease burden, promote greater equity, and integrate oral health promotion into the NCD prevention and control and development agenda. The key role that diet and nutrition plays in global oral disease will be addressed in great detail this afternoon by experts in the field. I just want to congratulate you for taking on this topic of immense global health importance. Thank you.
Live in each season as it passes. Breathe the air, drink the drink, eat the fruit. Thoreau's poetry reminds us that what we eat and what we drink not only feeds our bodies, but also nourishes our souls. Indeed, for centuries, how we have celebrated our religious ceremonies and also how we demonstrate our love and comfort to one another, they all revolve around food and drink. And yet, somewhere along the way, we have become disconnected. Disconnected such that many countries in the world today have now become nations of the overfed yet undernourished. This is why it's my pleasure to introduce our next speaker, Dr. Reva Tauger-Decker from Rutgers University. Dr. Tauger-Decker is a registered dietitian and is internationally recognized for her expertise and leadership in nutrition and oral health, nutrition-focused physical exam of the oral cavity, and advanced practice dietetics education. Her research has explored diet and oral facial pain, nutrition and tooth loss, nutrition and oral and facial cancers, worksite wellness, and nutrition-focused physical exam practices of dietitians. She has authored multiple peer-reviewed publications on nutrition and oral health and is the co-author of the Oral Health and Nutrition Position Paper for the American Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. She is on the editorial board of Topics in Clinical Nutrition, as well as the Journal of the American Dental Association, where she represents the Nutrition Research Group of the International Association of Dental Research. Dr. Tauger-Decker is a professor and chair of the Department of Nutritional Sciences in the School of Health Related Professions and the director of the Division of Nutrition in the Department of Diagnostic Sciences in the School of Dental Medicine. She has received many awards from the American Dietetic Association, the American Society for Clinical Nutrition, the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey, and she is also an elected fellow of the New York Academy of Medicine. Her presentation today is titled Nutrition, Diet, and Oral Diseases. It isn't a one-way street. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Tauger-Decker.
Thank you. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here and to be speaking on a podium with distinguished colleagues and to be spending the day, the evening last night and the day with distinguished colleagues. And as the woman who introduced me said, we do it all around food. Last night we had a wonderful dinner at the Slanted Door where several of the types of patients I'm going to speak of and our colleagues will speak of wouldn't be able to eat. So it's not what you said is so true, but we also have to think about that impact of the synergy between nutrition, diet, and oral health is more than a two-way street. And the first time we wrote the position paper, the first few versions of the position paper on nutrition and oral health called it a bidirectional relationship. In the last iteration, my colleagues and I realized, you know what? It's more than a two-way street. There are so many different directions, and I think, you know, we look at it in those directions. You quoted Thoreau, I go to Hippocrates, which said, let food be thy medicine, except when any of these get in the way. If we think about things like oral toxicities, which first came to light when we look at head and neck cancer, and their symptoms due to the treatment. So I want you to keep the terms oral toxicities and symptom burden in your head over the next 40 minutes because it affects more than head and neck cancer. Think of the oral toxicities of some of the dental treatments, systemic health treatments we give our patients, all meant to improve the care. But it's like when we hear the saying, the surgery is a success, but the patient dies. The treatment may be successful in treating the condition, but what are the other impacts of that treatment? Then symptom burden, which is the sum of the severity of the symptoms and the patient's perception of the impact of those symptoms on activities of daily living, on eating. So my objectives this afternoon are to explore the relationships between nutrition status, oral and systemic diseases, with a focus on the work we've done in head and neck cancers, oral facial pain disorders, and tooth loss, as well as our approaches to interprofessional collaboration that we've modeled at Rutgers School of Dental Medicine, and we started it over 20 years ago. Before it was called interprofessional, we called it transprofessional, we called it multidisciplinary. Whatever it is, it's when you have two or more professions working together to help our patients. I think the trajectory and degree of relationships varies with the disease, the treatment, and the patient response, that symptom burden. And there's no better example, I think, than head and neck cancers, because the patients are so, they're already ill when they come to us. It's usually lack of swallowing that brings them to the physician or the oral medicine specialist or their dentist. They then go through chemo and radiation therapies and surgeries, and the ensuing anatomic, mucosal, and sensory changes, which impact their ability to eat, but also their desire to eat. In turn, that eventually impacts nutrition status and eventually the treatment response. We often don't think, and we've done some work that shows that treatment response, their response to the treatment, whether it's chemo or radiation or even oral surgery, is dampened if their nutrition status is not up to par. So if you think of how the surgery, the chemo, and the radiation treat the disease, but the residual oral toxicities and symptom burden impact motor function and sensory function, and I try to consider both, let alone the social impact. We often see reduced mandibular opening, therefore biting and chewing force is impacted. Difficulty moving the food around in the mouth, so what we tend to call oral dysphagia, swallowing difficulty. Then on the other side, there's the sensory impact. Whether it's on appetite, because eating's associated with pain, whether it's on taste, food doesn't taste right, food has no taste, food tastes bad, aroma, or the feel of the food. And we often think of that food feel when you're thinking of the patient getting a maxillary full denture and you have the plastic covering the sensory feeling mucosa. Here the food feel may be altered because of the radiation therapy. And then the texture. We can see those sorts of oral toxicities in the head and neck cancer patient throughout the recovery process, and as I'll show you in a bit, even after that. That early stage from as soon as treatment completion to 3 to 4 months, the mid stage 4 to about 10 months, and then the later stage, that almost 1 year to 2 years out. And I think you all know, probably better than I do, the dental problems that ensue, the oral problems that ensue, and then the taste changes, which result in the nutrition problems, the diet and the nutrition. So the local impact, my ability to eat, then the nutrition problems that ensue because my consumption has gone down. Quality of life is affected because eating-related quality of life is affected. That whole socialization piece. And we tend to see weight loss and malnutrition and eventually an altered treatment response. So if we think about that symptom burden, we have to consider that these patients need flexible diet and nutrition strategies because their ability to eat is dependent on the oral toxicities, the symptom burden, the adaptive behaviors. We then go further and break those adaptive behaviors, and again, I think you can carry this through to other areas of oral health as well, to the positive adaptive behaviors. I chop up my food. I use rinse and spit agents to allow myself to eat. To the maladaptive behaviors, I'm not eating. I'll avoid foods. And in turn, the impact of that on nutrition status. So, you know, here you may think, all right, it's a one-way street, but it's not because it turns around and affects the oral health integrity as well. So, we sought to answer that question, and there was a tool developed by colleagues of ours at Vanderbilt, by Murphy and Cooper Smith and others, that looked at, it's called the Vanderbilt Head and Neck Symptom Survey, and it looks at acute and late effects of concurrent chemo radiation and has patients rank them from 0 to 10. And it's been validated in the head and neck cancer group. And it assesses symptom severity and that patient perception of symptom impact, so symptom burden. Looks at nutrition, looks at swallowing, eating concerns, so what concerns the patient about eating? Not our concerns, but theirs, the consumer. Xerostomia, mucositis, mucosal sensitivity, speech, taste changes, dental health. So in this study, we looked at, I don't have a pointer, unfortunately, I'm sorry, symptom burden in head and neck cancer patients, and we had 43 adults at three different stages. So we had 15 in the early stage, 7 in that mid stage, and more of them were in the later stage. Primarily male, which is typical of the head and neck cancer group, 97% Caucasian. This was done out in Minnesota at a group of cancer centers. Their mean weight loss from diagnosis to treatment completion was 7.9% of their body weight. So if you think of how long the treatment is, let's say it's somewhere from 0 to 3 months, they've already lost 8% of their body weight by the time treatment's completed. And what we saw was additional weight loss throughout. We didn't start to see any gain until that late stage. So another 3.35% at the early stage, 4.25% at that mid stage. So you finally start to see a 0.5% increase by the time they're almost a year out. Why did we use percents? Is because we have to have some type of normalizing factor because they come in at different weights. So if we look at percent weight change, that allows us not to look at the pounds, but at the percent of body weight. So they enter the recovery stage already impaired. Then we looked at, all right, what are the VHNSS scores over time that remain problematic over those three stages? And if you look, the problems with dry mouth are fairly consistent independent of the stage. The problems with dry mouth that make chewing and swallowing difficult, so not just the problem, but that makes it difficult, continues. And taste is altered. So all of these are impacting their eating ability. And as you can see, there's nothing, even at the late stage, that has a severity rating of under 4. So even almost 2 years out, we think it's success. The patient has survived. They're back in their activities, some activities of daily living. But their ability to eat is significantly impaired. So then we took, and I apologize for the slide, but I'll walk you through the key points. This was published in Support of Care and Cancer. We looked at symptom burden scores, oral energy intake, so calorie intake and protein intake. And we looked at correlations with and without controlling for weight change. So you can see mucosal sensitivity without controlling for weight change has a moderate correlation, that the greater the weight, negative weight change, the lower the energy intake. Once we controlled for weight, it was no longer significant. That was in the early stage. In the mid-recovery stage, where we saw the issue was with dry mouth, independent of whether or not we looked controlled for weight change, dry mouth and protein intake and calorie intake had very high, very strong correlations. So the more the problems with the dry mouth, the lower the energy intake, the lower the protein intake. Same thing with mucosal sensitivity during that mid stage. So that 4 to 10 month treatment stage is really a major problem because they're continuing to drop weight. And this is when you're trying to get them to recover and regain something, and they're still losing, and these are the reasons why. During the late stage, there was no longer any significant relationships, but as you saw in the earlier slide, the problems ensued. So what did we conclude? And I'm sure you can guess this as well, that we need to recognize and assess the impact of the specific symptom burdens on the patient's diet, on what they are eating and why. on their weight, on their nutrition status, and on their quality of life, because food is socialization. And distinguish between the maladaptive and adaptive behaviors. That would mean we'd have to talk to the patients and really look at this qualitatively. And diets need to be designed to manage the burden, minimize the weight loss, and maximize quality of life, yes, restoring their health. But we can't do that unless we can figure out what are the maladaptive and adaptive behaviors. So it led us to the question of what happens in the long term. What happens to these people over time? So that meant us doing a mixed method study, and we continued this much because my graduate student moved, and we did it with a group at Vanderbilt University, where we had we went until we had saturation of variables, so we ended up with an N of 10, mean age of 55, primarily male again, an educated and working group, because these were long-term survivors that were 3 to 11 years post-treatment. The majority of them had resumed social alcohol consumption, and they had all had concurrent chemo radiation. Some had also had induction chemo, and half of them had had surgery. We went with the following theoretical model, which was based on some of the issues we've seen in patients who are survivors of bowel disease who are long-term dependent on TPN, total parenteral nutrition, thinking, was there a relationship there? So we looked at how is adaptation affected by physical and functional loss, psychological support, so what support did they have, underreporting, senses of loss, yearning, regret, coping, body image, self-image and identity, and we heard a lot of that this morning in discussion with some of our other colleagues, and current health, and then said, what's the impact of all these things on symptom burden, eating, and how do survivors adapt? So what did we find? What you can see here is the gray bar is the data from late stage in the prior study. Yes, a different sample, but we thought it was important to show the two. The red bar is what we still saw. So if you notice that there is still nothing that has a VHNSS score in these 10 people below about 2.5. So you have long-term ensuing problems with taste, dry mouth, and duration of eating is the longest, is one of the bigger problems that's consistent, and how the lining of their mouth is sensitive. So the two biggest things were these two factors. So what were our conclusions? Because the qualitative interviews of these patients did not at all match the VHNSS scores, because they learned how to adapt. They took survival and took it from that perspective. Those who were the furthest year out, so the subjects that were 9, 10, 11 years out, really saw no problem. So it takes me 2 hours to eat. I don't care. So I go out and I play with food. I don't care. It was a very interesting dichotomy. So the patients worked with my student researcher to come up with this adaptation model. And the thematic categories that we had were the functional impact, the social impact, the psychological impact, and then the quality of life and the quality of life with the eating experience. The themes we saw were fluids with meals were a given, and they figured out what fluids they needed. They dealt with mucosal sensitivity by changing their diet. They dealt with limited food taste by highlighting the senses they could taste. They dealt with compromised dentition by cutting and chopping their food. They adapted food preparation, or they adapted the restaurants they went to. One subject was, I remember reading this, it was so poignant. She didn't go out to eat, and it was a celebration of her best friend's birthday because they were going to a Mexican restaurant and there was nothing she could have there. And she said that was the turning point in her life where she realized she had to take the initiative, she had to be the suggester to figure out how to reintegrate herself into society when it comes to eating. The social impact was learning how to make food choices, learning how to select items on a menu, how to eat in front of others and in public. This morning in our group, in our smaller group, we were talking all about malocclusion issues that some people are seeing around the world. And I would chance to say that some of these social themes probably apply in those groups as well, because people choose not to eat because they can't eat in front of others the way people think of it as normal. The psychological theme that was most striking was their downplaying. They're adjusting to the current situation. They downplay the symptoms because they're alive. And this, whether their methods of coping and support and resilience, that they're a survivor, they could get through this, they can learn how to adapt. They looked at enjoyment of eating and how when it's easier and harder over time. It was very enlightening to us to see this. So we're continuing to look at this. Our next level of research in this is we're just writing the protocol to start to look at the piece of how do we assess the maladaptive and adaptive behaviors, and what do we do with that information? Because that's what's needed to evoke change. So I'd like to switch the picture now to our work in orofacial and oral pain. And I've been fortunate to do work with our group in New Jersey, but also to do some work on an international level with folks at Hadassah Hospital. And as timing would have it, one of my colleagues from Hadassah has now moved to Rutgers, so we're continuing to do some of our work, particularly in the oral facial pain area. So we've looked at muscle and joint pain as well as neuropathic pain. We've looked at myofascial pain, pain related to TMD, whether it's articular or joint pain, or the mixed joint and muscle. And what's the impact of that functional challenge in terms of limited mandibular movement that's aggravated by the function of eating? Talking as well, but as a nutritionist, I'm focusing more on the eating piece. We've also done some pilot work, which our colleague in Hadassah is now starting to look at how we're going to expand it, looking at oral lesions. We are, in fact, the eating process, the lesions are aggravated by the sensation of the food. So when you think about it, what's the impact of that movement on the disability of oral function, whether it's eating, drinking, or talking? It prompts the question of symptom burden once again and adaptive and maladaptive behaviors. So here we think, wow, we've always thought all these factors impact on diet and nutrition. But what if there's more than a one-way street in each of those relationships? Those medications impact diet and nutrition, but in turn, they may impact the medications as well. Unfortunately, many of the medications used in oral facial pain can have a side effect of dry mouth, which again impacts food choices. And unfortunately, often those patients turn to sugar intake, which our colleagues will be talking about later. The mood disorders and depression and fatigue that may or may not exist before or independent of the oral facial pain as well impact it. Limited mandibular opening with or without pain, and then the pain associated with oral function. So we always have to keep in mind that the mouth is, yes, it's the first 6 inches or so of the GI tract, but it's the gateway to our nutrient intake. So we did a pilot study where we looked at weight, self-reported height, weight 6 months ago, and then visual analog scale scores for pain on biting pain on chewing, and mandibular opening. And we had two groups of patients that were coming into our oral facial pain clinic. We had those who had musculoskeletal pain. There were about 54 in that group, so they were the majority of our patients. And these were patients with either myofascial pain or painful TMD, and then those with neuropathic pain. What was interesting was that we're finding that it's the painful TMD myofascial group that has the consistently higher VAS scores for general pain, biting, chewing, and mouth opening. Whereas you see that the neuropathic group has a fairly high VAS at 3.76 for general pain, but the rest of them are all below 3. So they're not having trouble eating. But what we did find, interestingly, is that group had a higher mean BMI. They were much more likely to be overweight or obese than the TMD group. And now we've just written the protocol where we have one of our international students getting ready to look at more closely a mixed method study to say what's causing that problem. Why is that relationship there? We see in the musculoskeletal group the higher visual analog scales. So is that causing them to avoid food and they're thinner? Is that the reason? Or is the neuropathic group, is it due to some of the medications they're on, and are the use of some of the medications used with neuropathic pain, some of our antipsychotics, anti-anxiety, are those causing them to be heavier because they're associated with increased appetite? So we're going to try to explore that a little bit more. So that then led to a just fortunate experience doing some work looking at oral pain, so oral lesion pain and dietary intake and composition with a group in Hadassah. And I was fortunate to work with Rakefet Cernitsky and Rafi Benoliel and some others there on a project where we had mostly patients with oral lichen planus, erosive lichen planus, pemphigus vulgaris, and mucous membrane pemphigoid. And we divided them into a study group, so those that had a VAS, a pain score of 1 or less, and then, a control group or a non-study group, which had the VAS score of 1 or less, and then the study group, which were the higher VAS scores. Now, this was done in Israel, where at Hadassah, where most of our population were either, were all Middle Easterners, they were all Israeli or Palestinian. But what you see is the impact of the pain on their cultural diet. The study group was much more likely to avoid harder foods, like some of your breads, citrus and tomatoes, which are a mainstay of the Middle Eastern diet, sour foods, culturally very common in their spices and flavorings, and spicy foods, as well as a higher temperature, and of course alcohol. So we're now looking again to get another study started to say, okay, how do we change the adaptive behaviors? Can we teach them a way to enjoy some of their cultural foods? We have a lot of questions. And part of it is, the more you look at this research, and you probably know as well as I do, that there's so much heterogeneity in how we do our research that it's really hard to compare some of the studies. So we're trying to determine what outcome markers to use to look at diet. Is it nutrient intake? Is it food group intake? It's really a tough question to answer, and a lot of it depends on what do you want to know, and therefore which tool to use, and is there a validated tool? What are we looking at for nutrition? Because diet and nutrition are two different things. Diet are the foods we eat, whereas nutrition is the assimilation of those processes of digesting the food. So how do we explore nutrition? In children, we often look at markers of growth status and anthropometrics. In the oral facial pain patient, which is more likely an adult, how do we look at nutrition status? and then for orofacial pain. And then what are the impact of the disorders, either by type or by stage of diagnosis and treatment, on nutrition and on diet? And then, again, the flip side of the coin. What's the impact of those factors on the condition? If you can give me better eating-related quality of life, would I have less pain? You know, am I less focusing on that pain? The whole concept of socialization and normalization. If I can eat with my friends, am I less likely to think about the pain, therefore have a lower pain? It's a very interesting dynamic, and that's why we've been caught up in some of this and are just making some of those decisions to say this is the direction we have to go in. So it's one of the areas where there's very little research. So, now let's look at tooth loss. And what happens when we look at a different type of functional change in diet and nutrition? As you can see, much of the work that I've done has looked at the non-caries piece, and that's by nature of my own background and the expertise I've had available to me to collaborate with, both in students and in colleagues at our dental school. And in the areas I've looked at, which are really that whole systemic nature, that long-term impact. So we know that globally, by 2050, those of over 60 are going to be about 22% of the population. I read a statistic the other day that in New York City, where I live, by 2040, there will be more than 2 billion elderly. And then I realized I'd be one of them. But they're doing all these new discounts to attract the elderly in New York City, so that's a good thing. But the other scary fact is that 30% of people aged 65 to 74 have no natural teeth. And Medicare and Medicaid are not very good when it comes to providing implants, let alone dentures. And the mouth, really, again, as I said, is that gateway. We need our front teeth to bite with and our posterior teeth to chew with. This became very visible to me is to the fact that it's not just replacing them to dentures. Early on in my career, I was an internship director at the Bronx VA. And there, every veteran could come in and they could get dentures if they didn't have them. And if they didn't want them, they still got dentures because that's what they do. You know, you're entitled to this and you're going to get treated. I mean, if they really didn't want them, they didn't get them. But, and it struck me as to, why are we forcing them to get it? And what if they don't want it? And why were dentures always coming down to the kitchen on their meal tray? It totally baffled me until I went to work in a dental school and realized patients telling you they take their dentures out to eat with. So it's always been an interest of mine to look at because it's a major factor. We don't think about how are they eating with it. And one of my favorite stories is a patient in our dental school, and we have nutrition faculty working with the dental students in the clinic. And I was working with a student, counseling the patient on diet for their dentures, and the student's doing the diet interview. And I said, let's ask the patient one more thing. I said, how does it feel to eat? Do you eat with your dentures? No. And at that point, the student said, you never told me that. And the patient's response was, you didn't ask. And it was a very poignant one, because we have to think about that masticatory ability is influenced by how many teeth they have, where they are, their occlusion, and then denture fit and retention. And to have a patient say, no, I don't go out to eat because my denture makes noise and it's embarrassing. So that prompted our question. And this study we just finished several months ago to say there's a lot of independent studies, but let's look at a systematic review and see if we can do it to say what associations exist between tooth loss and or replacement and malnutrition risk and weight status. So we looked at studies done in westernized countries, community-dwelling older adults. We looked at tooth loss or replacement, but the challenge you have, and you probably all know this, is that when you look at the studies, some look at number of missing teeth, some look at the pattern of occlusion, some look at type of tooth replacement. And so we looked at malnutrition risk and weight status. Our exposure variables, or our measures, were full dentition, partial edentulism, complete edentulism, whether they had or were getting an RPD or a complete denture, an RPD combined with a complete denture, an RPD alone, or implant-supported dentures. For our indices of nutrition, we looked at the mini nutrition risk assessment, or the MNA, because that's been validated globally in non-RD populations, so for others evaluating nutrition risk when it's not a nutritionist, and BMI because of the curve that exists between BMI and mortality, thinking those were two good measures, one of risk of malnutrition, one of a gross measure of nutrition status, and chronic disease risk. So we use standard methodology for data extraction. We use the Cochrane Risk of Bias tool and the modified Newcastle Ottawa tool. We looked at generalizability, and that's where one of our biggest problems came in, and then data synthesis and analysis. And we went through so many narrative and summary tables because we had at least two people reading or reviewing any article, and when there was any disagreement, there was a third or a fourth person, and a discussion came in. So what did we find? We found that fewer teeth and poorer occlusion were associated with higher malnutrition risk. But it's very hard to generalize that statement because of the various ways that people looked at tooth loss and occlusion. We found that complete denture wearers had higher MNA scores, so were better nourished than those who were edentulous, but they had lower MNA scores than those who were dentate. And those that were partially edentate, as soon as they got an RPD, their MNA scores improved. Then when we looked at occlusal status and BMI, so switching to the BMI measure, those that had fewer posterior occluding pairs, because those were what the BMI studies used, were more likely to be underweight or obese, so a non-normal weight, so to speak, although I hate the term normal, but either underweight or obese than those with more posterior occluding pairs. And from a diet perspective, here's where the interesting thing is. The less variety fruits and vegetables you expect, but more sugar-rich foods. Those with more missing teeth, again, were more likely to be underweight or obese than those missing less. And those with complete edentulism had a higher odds of obesity than any of the other groups. And again, those with only 1 to 7 teeth were the thinnest, so had the lowest BMIs, compared to the edentulous or those with more teeth. When we looked at it with dentures, there was no significant difference among all the denture groups. But as we know that research has shown, the implant-supported denture was associated with better chewing, healthier diet quality. And I think that's a really important point because very often these patients' diets have changed over time, so simply giving them new teeth doesn't change their eating. And better body composition than complete denture, and clearly better chewing ability. So what did we conclude? Well, I'll make the key point, I think, is actually one of the last ones, that we could not do a meta-analysis, and it limited the strength of the research because of the heterogeneity of the data. Those with fewer teeth and poorer occlusion were at a greater risk of malnutrition and more likely to be underweight or obese than those who had all their teeth. Again, there's no causality. We can only look at the associations that we saw. There's limited results that show that implant-supported dentures achieve better chewing ability, healthier diet, and weight status, and we need more of those studies, but those are the expensive studies to do, and it's hard to get any coverage for the implant-supported denture research when it comes to diet and nutrition. The bottom line of all of this, though, leads us into that concept of interprofessional collaboration. None of this work that we've done could have been done alone by any one discipline well. because you need that in-depth knowledge of a variety of disciplines. And that became clear to me many years ago when I did my doctoral work after becoming a dietitian and looked at nutrition and dental education, and then was fortunate to come to Rutgers Dental School to set up a nutrition program and say, I can't just come in and do nutrition. I can only do it if we do it together. Because we have to look at how do we as independent disciplines screen and refer, but also work together. So WHO, since that time, has defined interprofessional work as when students from two or more disciplines learn about, from, and with each other. And I should have said professions, because they differentiate between professions, being nutrition, dentistry, whatever, and disciplines, being groups within a profession. The key elements include experiential learning, maintaining professional identities. So I'm not doing your work and you're not doing mine. We're doing our own things, but we're doing it together. Purposeful integration and collaboration among disciplines and professions as part of a team. And the goal is all towards improving that health. So as working together as dietitians and oral healthcare professionals, we can really care for that patient. And I think all of the global health problems that we've heard so far and we'll hear more of today really hinge on that fact that we need to have comprehensive care. And if we're doing this research work or service work or training work in other countries, we have to do it together. And to that, and had I known a little bit more about this morning before today, I probably would have thrown in some of the slides on the work I do within my nutrition world, which is training dietitians in some other countries and in our own on how to do nutrition-focused physical exam of the oral cavity. Because if we as the dietitians don't look in the mouth and see, oh, no teeth, or no, mucositis, we can't just go by reading a note. We have to look at that patient completely and say, how do we adapt their diet? In the same frame, I teach the dental students nutrition and say, would you tell your grandmother to eat baby food? Your grandmother would tell you to go somewhere else. Say it's, you have to teach them to use their knife and fork as their teeth. So it's really training both disciplines how to do some level of screening and referral back and forth. What we've done, and I've had the pleasure of collaborating with some of our other institutions that are here today and bringing it into their schools, is we've created that synergy between nutrition and oral health and interprofessional collaboration. Our dietetic interns rotate with dental students in the clinic and work together for patient care and often for each other, because the dietetic interns may help the dental students lose that year one, year two weight. Dental students may help the interns with their things, but they also work together with the patients. Faculty teach across the two schools. We have a very strong nutrition component in our dental school. Same, we give lectures to our dietetic interns, our undergraduate students, and our graduate students. We collaborate in research, as I've shared, and there's even collaboration in our community service work, whether it's in our country or whether it's working abroad. So what's our model? And I'll sum up with looking at the models we use and the models used historically, you know, promoted now by WHO and others. We look at a health and nutrition risk assessment by the dental student, and we've been doing this now in a few iterations for 20-odd years. And when we first started it, my chair at the time over there, Rich Vogel, who's now at NYU, said, Reva, if we're going to do that, it has to be done in less than 8 minutes a patient. Because if a student is seen at best two patients in the morning, two in the afternoon, they have to lose less than half an hour. So I said, well, it's 6 to 8 minutes. That's 24 to 32 minutes in total. We compromised on that. So in all seriousness, we've limited it to components they're already looking at and a few others. They look at oral status. They do a quick diet screen, particularly in that screening stage, as sugar frequency and eating frequency. They look at weight and height, measure BMI, and they look at systemic and socioeconomic health. What do I mean by that is a simple question that asks, do you ever run out of money for food during the month? Because what we see, at least in the U.S., is that that last week of the month, food banks and food pantries and feeding kitchens grow in size because people don't have any money left. And if you have a high food stamp population, they're not coming to appointments the first week of the month because they get their check and they're enjoying their food. Patients are then triaged. Are they going to get referred outside of the clinic to a dietitian for systemic and oral health-related nutrition counseling? Because our nutrition faculty in the clinic don't do counseling for a patient with newly diagnosed diabetes. We're working within the clinic, within the students, and their parameters. Or are they going to counsel that patient as part of their treatment plan on nutrition and oral health? If they get referred to a dietitian, she or he is going to do an assessment and provide medical nutrition therapy. For example, the patient with newly diagnosed diabetes, obesity. If the dental student is doing it, they're going to do a diet counseling relative to disease or their treatment plan or function, caries, dentures. And our model is very similar, and that's the model we've been doing for years, to what WHO's framework is for interprofessional education and practice. It's really looking at interprofessional education so that we have collaborative practice, so that we can optimize our health care and eventually optimize our population and hopefully have improved health outcomes. And with that, I'll conclude. Thank you.
So we've heard a lot about your educational program and trying to get dentists in training to be able to collaborate and in a two-way street relationship with dietetics and training. How about the dentists who are currently in practice, who may feel very confident in their ability to deliver a removable prosthesis, but not very confident in their ability to assess a patient's nutritional status? What steps could those dentists in practice take to be better assessors of a patient's nutrition status or find the right referral? Where should they be starting?
Good point. In one of the areas, and we've worked with a couple of folks in different areas, we have a project starting now with pediatrics where we had a small grant to develop some education tools, YouTube videos that are going up on websites and whatnot. But within the adult practice community, it can be for referrals, it can be looking to your local dietetic association and just Googling them and contacting them. The Academy of Nutrition Dietetics has a Find a Dietitian resource on their website. And in gaining their own skill, and I think that's where we have some of the biggest problems, not just with dentists, but with dietitians as well, is dare I learn, I have to keep learning. And we see that in the dietetics community and trying to teach them how to do oral screening. Same thing in the dental community, to think, I don't have time. And the I don't have time is the common denominator across both. Within the dental community, I think it's training the triaging that care within the dental office, whether it's the hygienist. Very often, even the dental assistant can be sent for training on how to do this and look at opportunities.
Well, thank you. And
thank
you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.